Please join me in welcoming Georgia from Los Angeles.
Hi, everybody. My name is Georgia. I'm an alcoholic. Really grateful to be here and to be sober. Thank you, Lee, for inviting me. We're in the same sponsorship lineage, which is really cool. I love being able to share that. We've been friends for a long time, and I'm so grateful to be sober. I'm grateful to be here with my favorite person, my husband, Trenton. I busted him out of the hospital yesterday. He has not been well. He has COPD, so when anything comes up, a cold, a flu, whatever, it can be life-threatening to him. And it started on Sunday night, and he was having trouble breathing, and it was really scary. And I remember it was like midnight, and I was going to do something. I was getting a bag packed in case we had to go to the ER. And I walked out of the bathroom, and I thought, I wonder if tonight's the night that I lose my husband. Not in a high dramatic way, but just in like I really thought maybe this is it. And obviously he's still here and all is well. But it just, those moments make me realize how precious every moment is, you know? And I am thankful for every moment that we get together. It's been such a lovely ride with you. And I'm so grateful for my life today. I've been sober since February 1st, 1993. I got sober when I was 24, and I thought my life was over and I would never have fun again. And it's just been the opposite, you know? As a result of doing things I don't want to do every single day, I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. And today, you know, it's funny, with almost 32 years sober, I'm more quickly, I will call my sponsor, I'm more apt to ask for help more quickly because I don't want to miss any more moments. I don't want to screw anything up anymore. You know, I know if I'm involved in the situation that there's that fourth column that we look at, that there's something that I need to do, change, whatever, because I wasted so much time, well, maybe not wasted because it got me here and whatever, but I spent a lot of time, you know, living in regret and remorse, and I'm so grateful that I have this new way of life. And to our friend Rob, thank you for joining us tonight. It's so nice to see you. And I don't remember when I had my first drink, but I was arrested for drinking in public when I was 11, which just blows my mind. Trenton has a grandson who's 12 and still believes in Santa. I lost my virginity when I was 12. I was pregnant at 13. By the time I was 13, I was on my second suicide attempt. And I had one last suicide attempt right before I got sober. But I grew up really fast. My dad died of cancer when I was 6, and I was raised by a single mom. And my mom had to work 3 jobs to keep a roof over our head. She worked in a school cafeteria during the day, and then every day of the week, she cleaned a different person's house. And then on the weekend, she cleaned a church. And when she was at home, she was depressed and angry. She didn't sign up to do this alone. She wasn't prepared to, you know, raise me. She was going to be a stay-at-home mom. And, you know, those first 6 years of my life were, you know, that idea. You know, she was home with me. My dad went to work. We had a Christmas tree and we had Easter egg hunts. And, you know, my dad would hold my hand and walk me to school. And, you know, I had all those sweet memories. And then my dad got cancer. He died and everything changed. And our house was sad and it was lonely, and I was daddy's little girl, and I couldn't articulate it at the time, but I just had the sense if I could find someone to love me, I'd be okay. And so I was always looking for someone to love me. My first higher power was your approval. I needed it like I needed oxygen. And at home, my mom was checked out. When she was at home, she was in front of the TV. I would say something like, hello, and she'd be like, not now. She would just be at 10 when I would just say hello. And so I spent a lot of time in my room crying, a lot of time in my room listening to music. And then I started hanging out with the older kids in the neighborhood, and they were smoking and they were drinking, and I always looked older than I was, I always felt older than I was, so it was easy for me to just jump in with that group. I was about the height I am now in elementary school, which is a bummer because I was trying to be cute and stuff, and the kids came up with a nickname for me, and it was BFU, which stands for Big, Fat, and Ugly, and that's not what I was looking for. And those old ideas are really hard to shake. By junior high, the kids came up with another nickname for me based on the size of my lips, which I will not repeat tonight. But later, people started paying to have their lips done, and I was like, ugh. But I always felt awkward. And then, okay, so now where I live. So my mom is, you know, working these hard labor jobs. We're the house in the neighborhood that has the overgrown yard, old cars in the driveway, junk in the front yard. We're the house in the neighborhood that brings the value of your house down. And so there's a great deal of shame in that. And our house was never cleaned. It was a mess. My mom later became like a full-blown hoarder. This was just pre-hoarder years. But so I was embarrassed of my house. I was embarrassed of how I looked. I was embarrassed of everything. And just desperately wanting someone to love me and just feeling so alone. And I feel like I was born with these really big emotions. Like, I was born singing the blues. Everything was big. I mean, my dad dying, of course, is a huge thing, but everything else too. You know, if I felt like a teacher looked at me funny, or I wasn't going to get an A, or, you know, just little things, I just had to leave. I could end friendships, you know. I was just so woundable, you know. I was just like a raw nerve. And so when I started hanging out with the older kids, I was stealing my dad's Buick Wildcat was left in our driveway a few years after he died. And I used to take that 8-cylinder beast out and go cruise it around the neighborhood with all the neighborhood kids. And I was smoking, I was drinking at 10 years old. It's insane. I look at kids that age and it just blows me away. But that's what was happening. And so I was student body president in sixth grade. And then I dropped out every single grade after and either would go to summer school or continuation to make it to the next year. And alcohol was the only thing that ever felt like, it felt like a magical ticket out of myself. My life was so sad. There was nothing to look forward to. I mean, I think about that too. The older I get, the sadder I feel about all those suicide attempts. Like at 12 years old, I was already at a point where I thought, what's the use? There's nothing to look forward to. Why even bother? I mean, that's so sad. But then I would drink, and it was fun until maybe it might be the night where I start crying about how my dad died when I was six, and then everybody has to take care of me, or I decide I'm going to go beer bong in the backyard with a bunch of guys and projectile, you know, puke all over everyone, or, you know, so I was that girl too. But mostly I was fun. And you know, like I said, I was always looking for someone to love me so I'd be okay. And how that manifested is, I really wasn't able to see this until I got to my fourth column and my fourth step, where I got to see I was kind of a hoe. And I didn't mean to be. I genuinely meant just to find someone to love me so I'd be okay. And I watched a lot of TV, a lot of movies, and it seemed to me once you find love, everything else falls into place. I did not aspire to be a doctor, a lawyer, or anything. I had no dreams other than find someone to love, and then everything will fall into place. And it wasn't until I had double-digit sobriety that I learned that a man is not a plan. What? Like, for decades, that was my only plan. That, number one, that's my plan. So that was a rough go. But so my life was super messy, and you know, I drank like a pig always. There was never like a line I crossed. Obviously, at 11, I'm already arrested for drinking in public. So those were the years it was working. And, you know, when I was younger, it was cute. You know, oh, hey, do you guys know what I did last night? Oh, my God, you won't believe what you did. You know, it's so cute. And, oh, you did this, and you danced there, and you said this, or whatever. But then later, it's not cute anymore. Like, you're getting into your 20s, and they're like, do you remember what you did last night? No, my boyfriend, you know, like. And I always had some reason to excuse my behavior. Like, if you knew how hard my life was, if you knew how lonely I was. So my only family was my mom and my grandma. I lived with my mom, as I said, and my grandma lived. I never get to share about this so specifically, but my grandma lived in Cambria, but not like Cambria on the ocean. Cambria in the middle of the woods, and like a 800 square foot house that was falling down. And my grandma was the meanest human being I'd ever met. And she did not like me. Now, you may say, oh, I'm sure she loved you. And no, she would tell me all the time what a piece of crap I was, how I ruined my mom's life. If my dad were alive, how disappointed he'd be in me. In any family picture where she's standing next to me, she looks like this. I mean, she did not like me at all. And so growing up, so first 6 years, you know, kind of the, like, told you kind of a normal life, stay-at-home mom. Now, six on, Any long weekend, any summer vacation, every holiday, we've got to drive up to see my grandma. And I wasn't at an age where I was like, oh, this is beautiful. Look at the ocean and the beautiful scenery. I had to leave my friends. I had to go stay with these two women who I thought were mean and crazy. And we'd go to my grandma's tiny little house, and my mom and grandma would watch brown TV all day, like Bonanza and old westerns, and everything was brown, and they'd smoke, and they'd be in their pastel house coats all day until maybe late in the day we'd go out to dinner. But first they'd have to go to Camozzi's or Reale's, which were the two bars. Sometimes they'd go to both while I waited in the car. Then maybe we might finally get to dinner. Every trip, we'd go to the Brambles. At least that one night we'd go to the Brambles, which was a fancy restaurant in Cambria. And I loved going there. And the owners would come by the table and say, how is everything? And we'd be like, oh, it's delicious, thank you. And I never had that experience, so I just loved that so much. And I tell this story because my mom and grandma did not think that I had a problem with alcohol. When I got sober, they were like, oh, I'm glad you have a crutch. Everybody needs a crutch. And I always thought, how could they not see? And then this story came back to me one day when I was speaking many years into sobriety. We were at the Brambles, and my mom and grandma had been to Reale's and Camozzi's. Now we're at the restaurant, we're ordering, and they're drinking at dinner. And all of a sudden, my mom and grandma start fussing at dinner. And then my mom grabs a napkin, runs to the bathroom, comes back to the table, and she's all upset. And I said, Mom, what's wrong? And she looked at me as if I should know. And she said, Georgia, your grandma shit her pants. And I went, at the Brambles? You know, no. But the worst part about it is they ordered another drink and lit a cigarette, and we stayed for another hour. And so when I think about how they didn't think I was an alcoholic, I think, oh, maybe it was because I hadn't shat myself at dinner yet. But but these visits at my grandma's house were horrible for me. And, you know, I started hooking up with people I didn't know. Like, hey, I'd be walking down the street and people would pull over and go, hey, we're partying at the park, you want to come? And so I had a really bad reputation in that town, a bad reputation back where I live. But at night, my grandma, who drank all the time, she always had a drink in her hand. And I don't know why she would say this to me. I didn't ask. But she'd say, you know, your grandma's not an alcoholic. I'm just a drunk. Now I know those words are the same thing because I have a thesaurus and I go to AA. But back then I didn't know what she meant. So she would come into my bed at night and she would tell me all the things about how bad I was and selfish and blah, blah, blah. And then she would tell me that she was going to be dying soon too. And how was I going to feel when she died? And it really scared me because I didn't want her to die. I mean, I wasn't crazy about her, but I definitely didn't want her to die. And I saw how much, what my mom went through and my dad died, and it was overwhelming. And I knew the things that she was telling me about myself, some of them were true about what a bad daughter I was and all of that. And I didn't find out till much later that my grandma started telling my mom that she was dying when my mom was 9. And my grandma had her when she was 18. My grandma died from the age of 27 until she actually died at 90. But I didn't know that until much later. But back then, so just that feeling of my mom and grandma, I felt so much guilt and I hated to be around them, but I love them, and I was always told it's just the three of us. We have to stick together. The world is a hard, cold, scary place. You're going to have to work one day, and you're going to hate it, and people like us don't get the same advantages as other people, and you're going to fall in love, and people are going to break your heart, and we have to stick together. And I'm like, these two women are my people. Oh, my God. And flash forward. So those years of junior high and high school, I just party. I barely went to school. Like I said, I would just go to continuation or summer school to get to the next grade because I was smart, so I could catch up really quickly. And that's sort of what my life looked like. I would build it up. Alcohol would bring it crumbling down, build it back up, back and forth, back and forth. I was so tired. But when my mom finally knew I was going to graduate, she claimed bankruptcy, quit those three jobs, and moved up to Cambria to live with my grandma. And I was like, cool. Now Cuckoo Town is all contained. And I can live how I've always wanted to live. And let me just back up. I have never been grounded. No one's ever told me what to do, when to do it, how to do it, ever. But I had that idea that now I'm finally free. And I got a really great job right out of high school, drinking the way I was drinking. I mean, I always drank like a pig, but it's still kind of cute when you're younger and I could get by. But it was getting harder and harder. And I ended up getting a really great job at a nonprofit in Pasadena, and then I started having an affair with my married boss. This is not unlike me. I was getting lazy, and I liked my men pre-screened, meaning you did all the work, you picked them, they must be okay. And it was bad, and I swear to you, all of these years, I just felt like a victim. I felt like all of these things were happening to me. I could not see how I played any role in this. I felt like a victim of all the things that had happened to me until I got to that fourth column of the four step. Thank God for the steps. So I was working at that job, and I started doing really well, but then the affair came out in the paper. It was a big thing, and so I left that job, and I think I ended up right from there getting another job that was not so bad, but I was really, it was getting harder and harder to keep going because of the way I drink. Every time I drink, I get drunk, no matter how much I promise me, no matter how much I promise you, no matter if it's a work event, it doesn't matter, no matter if I'm driving, no matter if I'm not. And so it's just getting harder and harder. And I had one last suicide attempt. I had to have my stomach pumped, and I was just done. And my roommate had a brother who came to live with us because he had a little problem with crack cocaine. And his wife wasn't very understanding about his little problem. And spoiler alert, there aren't a little problems with crack cocaine. And he moved in with us, and he was crazy about me. And it absolutely didn't matter how I felt about him at all. I just needed someone to love me so I'd be okay. And but it's hard for me to be with someone who has a different buzz. And he started acting really weird. And I couldn't break up with him. And so I said, I want some. And then he gave me some of that. And within 6 months, I lost everything. I got evicted from where I live, fired from my job. And he sold my car for a piece of crack cocaine, which went for about $20 at the time. And I had no place to go. And so my best friend Diana and I, we grew up together. We've been best friends since kindergarten, and we used to party together, but she grew out of it, graduated high school a semester early, moved to San Diego, was living a big life, and she had the kind of family that I always wanted to be a part of. They sat down to eat dinner at the same time every day. They went on family vacations. They seemed to really love each other. They had plans for the future. Some of them went to college even. And so I would be invited to dinner from time to time, and I always loved to be with them. And so when I had no place to go, Diana got on the phone with them, and they said that they would make room for me in their basement, and they gave me a room in their basement. And so I went to live there. I couldn't go live with my mom and grandma. It was really far away, one, but also they didn't have room for me, and three, they didn't offer. Maybe that numbering needs to go the other way. Number one, they didn't offer. But anyway, so I went to live with Diana's parents, and I loved them so much. And so at that point, I mean, I'm not stupid. I know I have a problem with drugs. So I just won't do them anymore. And it doesn't work that way, as it turns out. Speaking of chapter three, you know, tonight when I drink, I'm not going to do this, that, or the other thing. And then all of a sudden, I'm waking up with a stranger. I'm driving drunk. I'm doing all the stuff that I just made a promise to myself that I wasn't gonna do. I remember when I was new, somebody said, you know, I was like, I'm a loner, I can't really trust anyone. I was trying to be all cool. And they said, you know why you can't trust anyone? Because you can't trust yourself. And I was like, oh, you're so mean. But then I realized that's true. I could never even keep a promise I made to myself. And so what happened was, I forgot to mention that there were several times throughout my teens and early 20s where I had been to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous with friends who needed it, because obviously I was surrounding myself with people who drank like I did, so some of them ended up in AA. And I remember going to meetings and, you know, all the God stuff. I'm like, I wasn't raised with any kind of religion. Don't believe in God. If there's a God, don't care for his work so far. That's not going to work for me. And then I remember some dude who's probably my age now got up to the podium and said, you know, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. And I remember thinking, oh, what a bunch of lightweights. Like, I did not get that. But this experience living with Diana's parents, I got to see my alcoholism up close and personal. I got to see all that stuff that we talk about in chapter three. I got to see how powerless I was. But now I thought, even if I wanted to, I couldn't go to AA because I had the crack experience. And somehow I made it. This is not true. But that's the story I made up, because I was always looking for reasons to be different and how I was tragically pitiful. And but anyway, so I'm drinking, I can't stop, I'm doing things I said I wouldn't do, so now I'm like, well, maybe I can't drink either. And so I thought, well, I'll just try white knuckling it. How hard could it be? Really, really hard and miserable. And so I like to document things. I keep like journals and all that kind of stuff. So I have my calendar and I put day one, you know, and then a couple hours later I'm drunk and then I'm crossing it out and it's like, day one, cross it out. And it was a lot of paperwork. And just one day I got tired and I just thought, it seems that my people are destined to be miserable. And if I'm gonna be miserable, I'd rather be drunk and miserable. And I just surrendered and I thought, I'm just gonna drink. My mom and grandma drank, I'm gonna drink. Whatever, this is my life. And just then, well, I poured myself a drink. It was white Zin in the box. And I was just about to drink from it and the phone rang. And it was a guy by the name of Jeff Monahan. He was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He was sober 8 years. And he had moved from Los Angeles to San Diego and happened to work at the same company as my normie friend, Diana. And she had begun confiding in him about her loser friend living with her parents. And so he offered to call me, and it was him on the phone. And when I answered, he said, I understand you have a problem with alcohol. And for whatever reason, I told this stranger, yes, I do. He just caught me at the right moment. And he said, I want to give you the number of a woman to call in AA, and he gave me the number of Pat Y. And I called Pat, and she said, my husband Vince and I are going to a meeting. Why don't you come with us? And for whatever reason, I got in my car, and I drove to the stranger's house, and I got in the stranger's car, which is not unusual for me, but to do but to do that sober was. And Pat and Vince took me to the big Wednesday Pacific Group meeting, which was different than any other AA meeting I'd ever been to. It was more like this meeting, where it seems like people are happy and sober at the same time. I always thought it was an or conversation. You were happy or sober. And so Pat said the magic word. She said, I'll be your sponsor until you find one. And started me on a really simple course of action, and that's going to regular meetings on regular days, calling her every day, just really simple stuff. And by having just a little bit of structure in my life started getting better right away. Now, I always thought structure was the man trying to keep you down. People over 30 who don't understand freedom. But I never had structure in my life ever. I'd never gone to school on a regular basis, never gone to work on a regular basis, never eaten a meal on a regular basis, never sat down to eat at a regular time. I've never been faithful in a relationship. I've never been on, like nothing resembling structure had ever touched me. And so by having just this little bit of structure, what happened was instead of, you know, it stealing my freedom, it's what gave me freedom. The more structure I had, the more I could breathe. The more structure I had, the more creative I was. The more structure I had, the more time seemed to bend. The more I did, the more I could do. It didn't work on paper, but it somehow was working. It was the complete opposite of what I thought it was. And so then I began to really be excited about it and want more, you know. So Pat had told me, you know, call her every day. So I was doing that, super awkward. Like, what do you say to a stranger? And she had like 17 years sober. She couldn't even remember what it was like to drink, I thought. And so go to regular meetings on regular days. And this is a great thing about being a member of a home group is everybody's saying the same thing and everybody's doing the same thing. So in my home group, everybody in the first year was doing the same thing. So I just jump in and do it and complain to the other people in my year. Did your sponsor tell you you have to do this? Yeah. Ooh. You know, but I started doing all those things, and my life started getting better, like I said. But I want to back up. When I was 2 weeks sober, right before I got sober, I went around. Oh, God, I'm very dramatic, in case you haven't got that. It was worse when I was drinking. But I went around to my old neighborhood, and I went almost kind of door-to-door to some people that I knew and said, do you know what happened to me when I was young? Was I abused? Did something happen? How was my dad? How was my mom? What did they do to me? Because I just knew it was whatever they did made me how I am. And I always knew that there was some kind of secrets between my mom and grandma. When we would go to stay with my grandma, they would always talk in this secret language, and they seemed to bear, like, they seemed to have so much anger and sadness that didn't seem in proportion to what was happening in the room. So I fancy myself a bit of a detective. So I've been through all of their personal belongings over the years, trying to unearth whatever the secrets were. And I had never found anything, so I kind of let go of that idea, and when I went around the neighborhood, nobody knew anything, so I'd given up that idea. Until now, I'm sober, a couple weeks into sobriety, and this family friend says, I know some stuff. And I was like, I knew it, which is my favorite thing to say. And so this family friend said, told me all these things. And I was like, oh, and I wrote them all down, because when you hurt me, I like to be super specific when I throw them in your face. And that was my plan, is I was going to go to my mom and I was going to tell her what I really thought about her. I found this out, how dare you, but something made me call Pat first. And I called Pat and I said, look at what I found out. And she said, it's so good you have that written down, you're going to need that later. And I had no idea what she meant. But she said, for right now, I want you to work on being a good daughter or granddaughter, which sounded insane to me. But I thought, I'm going to do everything I'm asked to do, and when it doesn't work for me, then I can say I did everything you asked and it didn't work for me. But so far, I haven't been able to say that 30 plus years later, thank God. So I don't know how to be a good daughter and granddaughter. So he came up with a plan, and that's that I would call once a week, write once a week, and then visit as often as I could. And I would know if I were doing these things that I'd done everything I could on my side of the street. And so I started doing that, super awkward at first, you know, the weekly calls. Ugh. I would always kind of have a current event on tap in case the conversation got weird. And so one call at a time, and then I started sending a card. And at first I didn't know what to write, so I was like, love, Georgia, and I'd send that once a week. But over time I started picking up the pace in those cards and kind of writing about my adventures in sobriety. I was hearing about how you guys were making amends to your family and writing letters and stuff. And so I might remember something sweet that my mom did when I was younger, and I'd put that in a card. Or I would tell her something that was going on with me and kind of let her get to know me. And so now I'm sending the cards every week, and now I start thinking about how they must be savoring each of these cards and maybe keeping them in a beautiful decorative box, or perhaps on a coffee table tied with a lovely ribbon, and maybe even from time to time on a cold winter's night like this, pulling one out and saying, oh, remember this one? Oh, that Georgie, she's so clever. And I found out that's not what was happening many months into this process when I made my weekly call, and I called and my mom said, well, we've been getting your cards, but grandma's been having to wipe them out to reuse them. And we're wondering if you could start writing them in pencil. And I wrote those cards in pencil for over a decade. And I want to tell you why, because this is the stuff. This is it. I now had a sponsor who told me I never have to go through anything alone ever again. I had a sponsor who told me I could take all my problems to her. I was beginning to have an experience of my own higher power as a result of going through the steps with a sponsor. I had more friends than I dreamed a girl like me could ever have. And I was beginning to learn that I had more tools than I ever knew existed. And it may not be fair, but he with the most tools has the most responsibility, and in this case, it was me. So I wrote those damned cards in pencil. And at first, I wrote a little bit less to punish them, which they didn't notice. Story of my life, even my punishments go ignored. But eventually, I picked up the pace. And this was such a great lesson in learning that I am only responsible for my side of the street. What you do on yours, none of my business. It's none of my business. And the exercise here was to be a good daughter and granddaughter, not if I deem them worthy, not if they reciprocate. There was no ifs. My behavior defines who I am. They get to choose whoever they want to be. And this holds me in good stead in every area of my life. At work, I get to be a good employee, even if other people aren't, even if my boss is a jerk, whatever. I get to be a good friend, even if friends commit friendship crimes. I get to choose who I want to be, and that's where all my efforts have to be. The only access to power I have is over here on my side of the street. Now, I will fiddle about over on your side of the street looking for power from time to time. I've never found it there. It's not there. So by taking these actions, what started to happen is my relationship with my mom and grandma began to change. It was taking these actions of loving them that made me love them. It was never them loving me. And that was a really good lesson I was learning too, that all that love that I was, you know, like, love me, love me, love me, so I'll be okay. The only thing that fills that emptiness is my loving you. Getting is good and getting feels good, but getting has never filled that emptiness. It's when I'm lonely, I've got to pick up the phone. It's Sitting in meetings, listening to your stories made me less afraid of my mom and grandma's anger and hurt. I mean, if you entered a room with them, you could feel their sadness and their anger. Like it would envelop you. You could just feel it. And it used to really scare me. But now that I was taking the right actions, I was doing everything I knew that I could. I was hearing your stories. I was just loving them. Love, 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 love. And I learned to take my mommy stuff to my sponsor and my girlfriends. And so, you know, I was told my first year, get a good first year foundation. All the time and energy you want to put into going into school, put that into getting your steps done. Get a little job to go to, in between meetings, no major changes, don't quit smoking, and for God's sake, no relationship. Well, I've been in relationships since I was 10, often more than one at a time. And so that was going to be tough, and I just thought, I don't understand what this has to do with sobriety. But I was doing all the stuff, and I made it to my first year, and I went through the steps, made it to my first year, and I stayed out of a relationship for a year and about an hour and a half, because I take direction really literally, and so I turned one at midnight, and at 1:30 a.m., I consummated a relationship with my new fella, and then we were engaged 2 weeks later, and we were married 6 months later, and I was married to him my first 5 years of sobriety, and those were great years, because we always put AA first, we stayed close to our sponsor, so when it didn't work out, we didn't have to be unkind to one another, we didn't have to fight over our home group, and that's all because of AA. By that time in my sobriety, I was really active. I'm a member of a home group, very active there, working with new people. I was working full time. I was taking classes and stuff that I was interested in. I was taking newcomers to meeting. There was always someone in my group that was sick, having surgery, sick, having meetings at home. So there's always a couple home meetings every week, and my life was just operating at a very high velocity, just like, And then what happened is I had to have back surgery. I'd had minor back surgery early in sobriety, but this time I needed a spinal fusion. And if all went well, it was supposed to be about a 6 month recovery time, but I ended up being in that 1% where something went wrong, and I ended up being bedridden for about a year. And during that year, I lost basically everything except my sobriety. I couldn't work. I had a really great job at HBO. I was so happy. I'd never had a job. I was like, you're gonna have to work one day and you're gonna hate it. I really love this job. And I had to leave that job because I couldn't work, I couldn't drive, I had to sell my car. I couldn't take care of myself, and it was my home group that took care of me. I had to have babysitters every night. I couldn't feed myself, I couldn't dress myself, I couldn't get myself to and from doctor's appointments, I couldn't do anything. And so, I had found my usefulness in being of service, and now all of a sudden I couldn't do that. And so I learned that a way of being of service was to allow people to help me, which was really humbling. And I had people babysitting me I honestly wouldn't have had a cup of coffee with. And I remember they were like, so Friday night, so-and-so is coming over. I'm like, the ex-nun? Oh, I don't think so. No. What are we going to talk about? But what ended up happening is I ended up having these really sweet relationships with people that I wouldn't have otherwise. It's like when you share a commitment with someone at a meeting and you get to know somebody in a different way. And I learned another thing during this time, which was there's certain people that I thought should have been there for me, but couldn't, but God gave me just what I needed, just when I needed it, and sometimes not a second before, and I was so well taken care of. Keith Carpenter is an old-timer who used to talk about the seemingly good and the seemingly bad, and I look back at my life at these seemingly bad times, and they turn out to be where some of my most sweet memories are held, where I felt the most connected, the most cared for, the most alive. And so my world had become pretty small during that time. I had a boyfriend, and a few months into my illness, he came to me and said he'd consider a relationship and a commitment with me when I was well, and he dumped me, and I was devastated. And by now, I had gotten Marilyn Slater as a sponsor. She's been my sponsor for the past 32 years. I called her. I called her with every update. Like, I've got to have back surgery, complications, can't work, can't drive, can't pay my bills, borrowing money from my normie friend Diana again. You know, just every time there was another thing. It was like my whole life collapsed during that year. So I called her and I'm like, and now I got dumped. And at the time she was learning to play guitar. So oftentimes I'd call her and she'd be plucking away in the background, which is not a bad way to get direction. And so I called her and I said, now I got dumped. And she said, This sounds like a wonderful country western song. And she started playing a country chord progression, and she sang my blues, and it made me laugh. And that's been one of the greatest gifts of my sobriety, is finding humor in everything. And having a sponsor who finds so much humor in my darkest moments is a great gift. But she does. She is the funniest person. And so, you know, I was full of uselessness and self-pity. And, you know, we can pray for character defects to be removed, but what normally happens is an assignment appears. And in my case, it appeared in the shape of a man named Mike Finch. He was 34 years old, and he'd been diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. And I'd watched him go from walking and talking to being paralyzed from the neck down. And the thing that never changed about him was his love for Alcoholics Anonymous. He used to say there's no cure for ALS except for AA. And his wife had also left him when he was sick. And I watched him. He sponsored a ton of guys, and they'd get in his handicap van, and they'd go to conferences and meetings in other towns just for fun. And they'd go to ball games. And I used to call him the Make-A-Wish boy, which is a little distasteful, but he had a good sense of humor. But he just lived in a different way. And so, you know, I was so full of uselessness and self-pity, and he was such a great example to me. I was in a lot of physical pain. My disease was debilitating, but his was fatal, and he was joyful. And so he and I became friends, and then we became more than friends. And I was able to be with him the last 6 months of his life. And I did not know I was capable of loving someone that way, because I always tried to buffer myself from the bad stuff. I don't want the grief, I don't want the sadness, I don't want the anger, I don't want those feelings, I want all the good ones, which is why I was always trying to get stoned, you know, like, just get me drunk. But what I've come to find out is that all those feelings are gifts of sobriety. And, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous gives us this beautiful net with God, sponsorship, the steps of fellowship, and so I get to love a man that I know is going to die because that beautiful net of AA is there to catch me. I get to pursue dreams and follow my faith because that beautiful net of AA is there. And there's a woman in my group named Julie, and her son died on his senior trip in a car accident, and she grieved for a really long time. And well-meaning people will say the stupidest things, and you must forgive them every day, forever and ever. But anyway, people were saying things to her about the length of time she'd been grieving. Maybe she'd been grieving too long, and making opinions like that. And I remember her saying something to the effect of, I want to feel every feeling that had to do with this glorious boy that I loved so much. It gives me goosebumps. And it just struck me that somehow she saw grieving this boy was part of the loving that boy, that was part of the blessing. And that always stuck with me, and I'm so glad that I was in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous with good sponsorship, so I got to be there with Mike, and I got to be there for all of the beauty in those last days. When somebody's dying, there's just no BS, you know, there's like all the stuff that you worry about in a regular day, you just don't anymore. Life is really simple. It's just a really simple, clear path. And those days were filled with joy and laughter, and we were surrounded with love, but it was also scary, gory, depressing. You know, I've learned when we're uncomfortable in situations to get a commitment. If you're at a party and you feel uncomfortable, start cleaning up, you know, whatever. Well, his house was constantly filled with all these people coming to say goodbye. They never knew, you know, is this going to be the time? Are we going to see this person yet? And so I had been reading Elizabeth Kubler-Ross about death and dying, and she talked about photojournaling. So I asked Mike if I could take pictures. And so I took pictures every day of that last 6 months. And so we have these three photo albums that are filled with laughter and tears and backs of ambulances and his dad kneeling at his bed each time he left, you know, and all of it. And it's just so beautiful and rich, and I would have missed it had I not been in the center of Alcoholics Anonymous. And in falling in love with Mike, I found something redeemable in me, because I didn't know I could love someone like that. You know, I'd always measured love in what I was getting. And about a month before Mike passed away, my grandma, the meanest human being I'd ever met, somehow started being nice, grandma. Now, I'm not sure exactly when it happened, but it was in that first year or so of sending the cards, making the calls, just tending to my side of the street, the phone calls started going like, well, you know your grandma loves you. And I'd be like, oh, no, I didn't. Inside voice, though. And But I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop. I'm like, yeah, let's see how long nice grandma lasts. And it lasted. It lasted all those years. My grandma never went to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, never stopped drinking, never did a step, and her life was profoundly changed by Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's because I was coming to you and taking love and service to them. I was bringing my stuff to you. And so by the time she died, we were good. In fact, she was my Granny Goose. That was my nickname for her. And we had the sweetest relationship. And about a month before Mike died, she passed away. And then Mike had gone into hospice. And his dad and I were there holding his hand when he died. And it doesn't always happen that way. But I'm grateful that it did. And it's something that I'll always treasure. I had moved to San Diego to live with Mike. I ended up moving back to LA. I was still having health troubles. You know, we're not supposed to say our case is different, but if you have chronic pain, our case is different. Because if you're in pain every day, it skews your perception. And but for me, what I learned is it doesn't mean I get to do less. For me, I have to do twice as much to feel half as good. I am not like my fellows out in the world with my drinking, but I am not like my fellows in AA either. I have friends who can do a meeting or two a week, maybe sponsor, maybe not, maybe have a commitment, maybe not, and they're happy, joyous, and damn free. Not me. I have to do a ton of stuff just to stay, but that's the power of knowing that. That's where the access to power is. I know that about myself, so that's the solution, and I can choose to do it or not. So I still suffer with chronic pain today. If you have suggestions or any kind of solutions, but thank you so much. I treat my chronic pain with Pilates and AA, and that works for me. Thank you. Okay, so... But I moved back to LA and I was really still suffering so much. Now, Mike had died, my grandma had died, I had all these physical stuff. And my mom asked to see me. And I had gotten a little job, started working again and, you know, kind of getting back into the flow of life, getting back to meetings with my home group back in town. And so I drove up to my mom's and it's so funny, that day I found out those secrets. I was ready to call her that day and tell her what I thought about her. Now it had been years, and I'd never even thought of picking up the phone to say anything to her about those secrets. And the secrets in the book were that my mom and dad were never married, that my dad was an alcoholic and a womanizer, that my mom had embezzled the money that my dad left me, stuff like that. And I had never found it necessary to mention that to her. So when I drove up to Cambria, we drove up to... can't think of the name of the place, Ragged Point. We had lunch up there, and then we sat outside at that beautiful, breathtaking view, and my mom started the conversation, and she said, there's some things that, now that your grandma's gone, there's some things you need to know. And she told me that at 8 years old, my grandma was sent to live with another family because her parents couldn't take care of both her and her sister. And where my grandma went to live, she didn't go to another day of school. She cooked and cleaned at that house, and she was physically abused and sexually abused. And the way she got out of that is she got pregnant by a man she didn't love and had my mom at 18. And by the time my mom was born, my grandma had left that man, and then my grandma started leaving my mom to stay with other families and then would leave her in boarding schools. And over the summers, when the other kids would get picked up, my mom wouldn't get picked up. She'd be left there in clothes and shoes that didn't fit her, wondering, you know, where are my people? And she didn't have anyone. She talked about, like, if she got a chocolate bar, she would have to stand in the middle of the room and, like, lick both sides of the chocolate bar so everybody saw. Like, she had no, I mean, I don't, that example just makes me, just how hard her life was and that nothing was hers and nothing... Anyway, that was her upbringing. And so occasionally my grandma over these years, wherever my grandma would leave her, she would come to visit her from time to time in fancier cars and fancier jewelry. And my mom always longed to be with her. And she got her wish. When my mom was a teenager, my grandma came and swooped her up, but it turned out that my grandma was involved in organized crime. And she was involved in racketeering and prostitution and had been running a brothel out in the Mojave Desert, and she was a madam there. And so at 15, she turned my mom out to work that business. And my mom never went to another day of school and was physically abused and sexually abused. And my mom told me about these two babies that she had when she was a teenager. Now, I didn't say this earlier. When I was pregnant at 13, My mom insisted that I terminate that pregnancy, and I did not want to. And I felt like she insisted that I do it because she wanted to punish me because I had done something bad, and she wanted me to feel the pain of my bad decision. And I had hated her for years and resented her. And it wasn't until I got sober and I heard we won't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it that I had any freedom from that. And so I hadn't thought about that, you know, but now she tells me about these two babies that she had and she put up for adoption. And I was like, oh my God, you know, she wasn't trying to punish me. She was trying to spare me the pain that she knew. And right or wrong, our perception is our reality. And so she knew that pain. And so she's trying to spare me. I'm like, oh my God. And she told me about what her life was like over these next 2 days, about the abuse she endured, about being sold by her mom, about what it was like to work that business. And I mean, I could not even imagine. I knew nothing of this about my mom. And I was so grateful as she spoke to me that I had some step work under my belt, that I was sober a while, that I had some recovery, that I didn't make it about me, and that I just listened like we listen to somebody's fifth step. I have never heard somebody's fifth step and not love them more. And I got to, I got to give her that freedom. And she hadn't spoken these secrets out loud in over 30 years. And there was such shame in it for her. And I got to say things like, I'm so sorry that happened to you. I'm so sorry. And I was so grateful I'd been given that direction to treat my mom like she was this awesome mom, to send the cards and make the calls and do all the stuff, even though I didn't think she deserved it. It turns out I spent my whole life being mad at my mom for not giving me something she never possessed. I thought she withheld love and guidance and all those things from me because she deemed me unworthy. But it turned out she never had it to give. And so another level of freedom. And because of this program, I got to give her all those things, you know, because I was full. I got filled up with the steps and sponsorship. And, you know, so I got to listen to her and bear witness to her story, you know. And after that, our relationship changed so much. I mean, we were both free. I wrote the cards in pen because my grandma was gone. But I kept the cards going, you know, and, you know, our relationship, it really, I could have never imagined it being that good. We had probably about 4 good years, and then she was diagnosed with lung cancer and bone cancer, and then it went to her brain. And I was able to take care of her the last few months of her life. And that would not have been possible. She never dated again. She never really had any friends. And that bridge that was built with the cards and the calls and me tending to my side of the street and me being a safe person, I was able to be with her at that most intimate time. And I tell the story because it describes her so beautifully, but she's 75 years old. We're going to the hospital for yet some other kind of test. I mean, we already know she's terminal. She's 75. And so we go in and the x-ray technician comes out and my mom goes, "This won't affect my ability to bear children, will it?" She was the funniest person. She was so beautiful, and she had great taste in music, and she was so kind. And it's like, you know, they say you can't change your past, but it's amazing that I looked at my childhood as being, I was so neglected and abused and all of this stuff, and it turns out that I had the life of a princess compared to the life that my mom and grandma had. And all of that, like, just shifted. And, you know, I began to have this mad crush on my mom. I just thought she was the coolest thing ever to have survived all of that and been who she was. And so I was able to be with her until she died, and I'm very grateful. I have just a few minutes to bring you up to speed to what's happening now. I have continued to stay sober. I've had lots of health issues. I've smoked, not smoked, smoked, not smoked, smoked, not smoked, smoked, not smoked. Right now I don't smoke. And the one thing that's remained consistent is I haven't picked up a drink no matter what. I hit a suicidal depression with double-digit sobriety. I wasn't willing to do all the stuff I was willing to do when I was new, and I fell into a really dark hole. And it took a long time to crawl out. And the way I crawled out is I made like a newcomer without picking up a drink. Went to a meeting every day, went through the steps again, and it was really, really hard. And what I've come to find out is that because I'm an alcoholic, my solution to all of my problems is the same. It's doing all the stuff to work on my spiritual condition. You know, all the stuff we do in the steps and calling a sponsor, praying, meditating, all those things. If I just work on those things, everything else seems to fall into place. But next to getting sober, the best thing that's happened to me is working at the Midnight Mission in Skid Row. I started volunteering there when I got sober, and I became an employee about 16 years ago. And so I get to take all the love and hope I get in these rooms to Skid Row every day. You know, this pile of crap that I came here with was magically transformed to gold! And now I have all this stuff, you know. And so I feel useful, and that's been a really great blessing. I have been married and divorced twice. I've had a series of monogamous relationships. Who's a good girl? they've all been monogamous in sobriety. Thank you. But I just had never found the one, and so I hit, you know, I'm in my 50s, and I'm like, maybe I'm just not going to find the one. You know, maybe I'm just, honestly, part of it was I felt, because of how I was raised and all of that, I'm not going to be a partner in that way. But I sponsored a bunch of amazing women, and I have so many friends, and I love music, and I go hear live music, and I love to dance, and I'm super active, and so I have this really big, beautiful life, and so I just kind of went, oh, it's okay. Like, I have a really good life. And then I settled into the idea that I'm going to be alone, and it's okay because I'm not really alone. And, you know, I was watching my favorite shows on TV, eating popcorn on the couch, going dancing, doing whatever I want, whenever I want, shaving my legs, not shaving my legs. And then my friend Trenton invited me to speak at his conference a year ago, April, and we'd been friends for a few years, and we started talking more at this conference, and he was in the same boat, single, and kind of had given up that idea. I'm not sure if his shaving status was the same as mine, but we started dating, and we hit it off right away, and it was so easy. It was just so easy, and I think it's because we're both super active. We're both complete. We weren't looking for each other to complete each other. We were already complete. And so a year later at that same conference, he proposed to me, and we got married in August. And again, you know, we can't change the past and, you know, whatever. But my story has been, you know, I have nobody required by blood or law to love me. When it comes around for open enrollment at work, you know, my life insurance was going to the Midnight Mission. I didn't really have a next of kin. I had a friend that was kind of my in case of an emergency call. And that always was a source of pain for me. And Trenton has these two great kids and six grandkids, and for whatever reason, they love me. And that's all easy, too. And it's so now I have this big, beautiful family. It's like my story keeps changing, and it's so strange, but it's just because I keep showing up to AA and doing the next right thing in front of me. Stay in the step, stay in the solution. And, you know, I love Trenton, and I feel so lucky. I really do. I'll close with this story. So I love music, and I find singing very cathartic. Not so much for my audiences, as it turns out. And that has been a source of great pain for me. I've done it like 40 plus AA shows. In my home group, we do shows for everything. So I'm like, you know, I'll do whatever. I don't care. Now, I can kumbaya around a fire. I've sung at weddings and funerals. I'm okay, but I'm not going to make a living at it. But that became a source of pain for me when people were saying, oh, you can be and do anything you want. And I'm like, well, that's what I want to do. Why would God give me this passion and desire only to have me suck at it? And I really went through a really dark period. And then I started working at the Midnight Mission, and I was exposed to all these people who have no access to art or music. And so I started a music program, and I started inviting anyone I knew who played a musical instrument to come and play in between lunch and dinner. Started with Doug Rowell. Doug, will you come down and play for our homeless guests in between lunch and dinner? And he came, and then another friend came, and then another friend. And what went from being once a month started being a few times a month. And because music is so powerful, it took on a life of its own. But what I learned from this experience is that maybe God gives us passions and desires, not for us to shine, but for it to shine through us. And so my job is to follow the passion and desire, but to stay out of how God wants to use it. Thank you.
Give her another round of applause. Thank you so much.